Welcome to The Pestle, reviewing and breaking down movies to look for insights into the movie-making process. Hosted by Yo Mama. Now, let's dim the lights and start the show.
Welcome, everybody, to The Pestle. Today's show is brought to you by Mr. Fusion, powering the future with the waste of the past. Cleaner power with Mr. Fusion. Welcome, everyone, to The Pestle. I am Wes.
And I am Todd.
And we are filmmakers. We do all the things in front of and behind the camera, acting, writing, directing, producing, musicing. I've really enjoyed the moments when you've scored stuff, not just for me, but like for practice, and listening to how you would approach a scene differently from some other composer. That's really fun and interesting to me. We don't often get a chance to see how someone would approach the same thing twice, right? There was a clip someone sent. I don't know if it was you or Scott or someone else on Instagram sent me a clip of Heat, because apparently Heat was a script before, and it was a movie before Michael Mann made it. And so there's another version of Heat out there with basically the same script, which means you can watch the same movie, the same script, directed by two different people. And performed by, you know, someone other than Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. Like, and seeing that kind of A-B testing, never. Like, you never get to see that on the big scale. And watching that is really informative, because there's so many different ways. Just because the words are the same thing on the page, the interpretation of it can be different in so many ways. From the performance, to the cinematography, to the direction, to the art direction, to the score, to the sound design. Like, every single thing that goes into one scene or one script can be different in a multitude of ways, in ways that you just don't really understand until you get to see that kind of A-B testing. And it's really informative and very cool. And to that effect, like, even watching Dune, done by Denis, you know, is so wildly different from David Lynch. And just, I haven't seen the David Lynch version in probably a good 10, 12 years, but wildly, wildly different films. And to me, that's the coolest thing in the world, is just to see what speaks to you as a director, as a writer, as an artist, versus what speaks of that same material, the same source, what is calling to someone else. And there's a multitude, and even David Lynch's Dune is different from Jodorowsky's Dune. Art, all that to say is, you know, people standing on the shoulders of others in so many different ways, and it's always open to interpretation. And I love that, you know, we get to sit and look at a film and say, this is how we're interpreting it. It's not the definitive way, because largely, you know, sometimes we'll dive in and see what a director had to say about this or that. But largely it is our own interpretation. And I love that we're just bringing Todd and Wes to this, and we're not trying to say that this is the only way to watch this film or to think about these things, because I've run into other people's opinions about a film we've covered that we've walked away like, man, I saw this. And then, oh man, you know what I see when I watch this film is a completely different story. And I'm like, whoa, yours might be closer to definitive. And that to me is much cooler that we walked away with something completely different. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, well said. You know, a great movie is left up to interpretation a lot of times. You know, I think that's, you know, one of the great things that Tarantino does. He doesn't give you answers a lot of times. He just poses questions. You know, Aldo Raine's Rope Burn. You know, where did that come from? Who knows? What was in the briefcase? Who knows? So, and I think a lot of great movies will leave that question, the spinning top kind of thing. And so, yeah, to your point, these are just our thoughts on these films. And what I do want to point out, that our thoughts aren't necessarily incorrect either. If somebody else has a differing opinion, it is just kind of like what it is in the moment. But there is something to be said about sitting down and talking to somebody else about, you know, the film and their experience. You know, I can go see a movie and not talk to anybody and just like have my thought of like what it is and just live with that. But the moment that I introduce that thought to someone else and that opinion to someone else, and they process it, it will affect their opinion. And then they tell me theirs and it will affect mine. I mean, that's one of the great things about having this podcast with you is that I don't ever watch films now and think just in a silo of like my own head. I think about like, well, I have my own opinion, but I think what would other people think about this too? And it could be you, or it could be my wife, or it could be a friend or whatever. I went and saw Dune with a friend, and he was like way more into the old version than I was. He had some really interesting insight that, you know, I did not know. So it's been a real educational thing doing this podcast with you, because now I watch movies vastly differently.
That's damn cool. I feel like I knew a few kids growing up that really loved Dune, and I was just like, okay. And I love sci-fi. Growing up, I watched every bad B movie, horror film, sci-fi thing that you could imagine, things you've never heard of, and loved them all. Like, I go back and rewatch, and I'm like, this is terrible. But as a kid, I was into it all. And I wasn't into the original Dune. I was just like, this is cheesy, not to my taste at all. Yeah, and just the difference between the Barons alone is enough reason to say, you know what, Denny's is the definitive version.
100%.
With that said, what are we covering today?
Today we are covering Dune Part 2. So if you haven't seen it, just came out. If you haven't seen it, please pause this episode, run to your nearest IMAX and watch it. And then, so we don't want to spoil anything for you, but we also don't want to spoil the OG Star Wars either. So it's probably a good idea for you to go watch the original trilogy. I would say you can steer away from any of the others. Agreed. Honestly. Agreed. Just the first original three, because they kind of overlap in some ways. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to talk about. We'll touch on some of that stuff, as well as the cinematography, exposing for story, backlighting with the sun, as well as some of the story and writing, Na Baron, and other such stuff and things and stuff.
And a quick synopsis of the film, which there's a lot of names here, so I don't do well with names, all right? So this is my job in the podcast, however, whatever, you're going to get what you get. Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen, while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve, written by Denis Villeneuve and John Spates. It's based on the novel by Frank Herbert, cinematography by Greg Fraser, and it's featuring Timothy Chalamet as Paul Atreides, Zendaya as Chani, Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica, Javier Bardem as Stilgar, Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck, Austin Butler as Na Baron, Fade Rautha, Dave Bautista as Raban, Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan. Yep, Princess Irulan. Christopher Walken as Emperor, Stellan Skarsgård as Baron Harkonnen, Charlotte Rampling as Reverend Mother.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. We don't have that here. Here, we're equal. Men and women alike. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Oh, Muad'Dib, Usul. Maybe you could be Fremen. Maybe I'll show you the way.
So many thoughts. I'm coming back to that scene just for the lighting, but you got to see this, and I haven't seen it in IMAX yet. I debated, but I needed a pure viewing experience, which I usually get at the Alamo Draft House. No talkers or phones or weird people doing weird things in my ear. And so how was the IMAX experience? I think also walking out of part one, we were a little on the fence. We're like, look, it's a solid film, but it's all set up. We don't really know where it's going yet. We'll have to judge part one really based on how part two turns out. And now part two is here. So does it pay off? Good film? What do you think, man?
Dude, you missed out. I sat in row three the IMAX and had my freaking hair blown back. I mean, the entire, my whole body, anytime anything with an engine was on, my whole body just vibrated with like energy and sound. Like there was so much low end. It was beautiful and glorious. It was fantastic. Man. Today, you need to go to the IMAX today and see it and sit as close as you can. I wouldn't recommend anywhere closer than row three. Actually, I think row four is probably ideal because whatever. But let me get the kind of a little bit of annoying stuff out of the way that I don't like. And then I'll tell you all the stuff that I did. There were some for me, and I think that you and I have this kind of like love hate relationship with exposition, and usually it's hate, as in like that was not needed. Why did you put that in there? And I feel like there are some moments that are like that in this film for me, where I understand what's happening. Like I really do. And I didn't need that little bit of, I didn't need that line that maybe Jessica said or something, you know, or that the Reverend Mother said or something like, and they were very sparing. I could probably pick out maybe six or so, you know, but they were usually single lines where it's like, okay, that wasn't for me. That line was for everybody who you're dragging along, you know, through this film, like who might not be into Dune at all, who might not be into sci-fi at all. Mm-hmm. Right. And they're just watching it because it's a cultural thing now. And like, everybody's talking about it. And so, but like the movie buffs, that line is not for you. That line is for the probably majority of people who might be there watching. So I understand that to a point, but there were to me a few, I don't know if you agree with that, but there were a few where I was just like, I didn't need that. Like that. And it takes me out of the film when those things happen, especially when they're like one-off lines. Like if you give me a lot of exposition in a smart way, you can give me a ton of it. You can give me 5 minutes of it and it works and it pushes the narrative of the story forward. But when you give me a line that could be removed, that is thrown away, kind of like a throwaway, then that line takes me out of everything. And I got to fit myself back into the story again. When I say myself, I mean my subconscious self back into the story. And that happened a few times in the film. And I hated that because I wanted to think this is a perfect film. I wanted to think it was like, couldn't get any better. Now, that being said, I do think that this is also a setup for the next one. And so, you know, if I go back after the third one and I watch all three in a row, I'll probably be like, oh my God, this is the greatest, you know, trilogy ever.
Right. Since Lord of the Rings.
Right. Exactly. You know, but just watching the second one as is, I did feel like there were a few moments where I was taken out of it. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah. I don't think there were any of those moments that pulled me out. Because like you said, they were sparing when they would dump some exposition. And so I think because he didn't belabor it, I can usually handle like a throwaway line. That's like you said, it's there for the audience in the back who maybe is only paying 80% attention, and we're going to make sure we don't lose anybody on this, you know, close to 3-hour ride. Fair. And so I don't think any of them pulled me out. I'm sure they popped up and I was like, oh, okay, thanks. but I was able to smoothly stay in it. There were other things that pulled me out, which we'll get to, but yeah, I think for me, yeah, I was okay.
Everybody's, the other thing is like everybody's freaking out about the performances. I'm not really crazy about Timothée Chalamet this time, to be honest. I don't at all think he phoned it in. I don't. I think that he was doing his best, but I don't know.
Can I jump in on that then? Because I kind of disagree in the sense that I completely agree with what you're saying.
But you think he phoned it in?
I think he didn't do his best.
Okay. All right.
Because look, it's not like he did a bad job. He didn't. He's Timothée Chalamet. He showed up. He did his work. I think there was a lot of texture that he didn't put on the character, though. Like There are so many moments, and this is, look, I'm not saying this is an easy role. I just don't think there was a lot of nuance. I think he played every scene the way the script said. And I don't think he left a lot in between the lines. If you compare what he's doing to what Zendaya is doing, Zendaya is the heartbeat of this film. You're reading so many emotions off her face and interpreting, and the context is there. So she knows she doesn't have to do a lot. And that might be the difference. I think Chalamet is trying to do a lot, and it's taking away from all the subtext that you could be reading from his performance. Whereas Zendaya, you're reading suspicion, right? She's always suspicious of him, but she also wants to believe he is who he's, you know, purporting himself to be. And you also know that she loves him and she cares about him. That comes through regardless of what she's saying. Like, there's moments when she's saying the opposite of what you think she's feeling. And that adds so much texture to what she's giving you, because you see that conflict in her. She's saying, I can show you the way. But even as she's saying that, you can feel her saying, you know what? But I don't know if I should, but I want to. I want to believe. There's so much in her performance. There's so much in, and by contrast, Javier Bardem is a knockout. He is crushing it. He is the best actor in this film, bar none.
Agreed.
100%. And he's playing the script to the bone. He's showing up and playing his scenes 150%, right? And you could say he's overplaying it, but he's not, because of how sincere he is. No matter if he's serious, he's sincere and then some. If he's happy, he's playing that and then some. If he's like blown away by the revelation, he's all of that and then some. Like, he says, you know what? If I'm going to play this character goes all the way all the time, and I'm going to play it that way. And so, you know, he's funny whenever he's not trying to be funny, but he's just so absolutely sincere in everything he's doing. Like, don't listen to the djinn. They'll whisper, they'll take over your mind, you know, but no, seriously, don't listen to the djinn. You know, and it's like, that's just who this guy is. He's just, you know, Stilgar. He's coming to life. And Austin Butler, fantastic. This guy came out of nowhere for me. And I thought he did a okay job as Elvis, and it was fine. But him as this character, I was like, I don't know who this person is. And I had to look him up in the credits to find out, because of how good he was as Knob Aaron. And then you have, you know, Timothée Chalamet step up to the plate. This guy, he's so much better. Go watch the difference between Paul Atreides and Call Me By Your Name. You're reading so much more into his performance whenever he's not saying anything at all, when he doesn't have dialogue, and even when he is. And you're reading emotions that are so much sitting beneath the surface and betraying what he's saying out loud. And he's not doing that in this film. He's doing exactly what the part needs to be and no more. And so whenever he has these outbursts, they feel true. I'm not saying he ever hits a false note in this movie. He doesn't. But I'm saying there was room to do something else, and we didn't see that. And maybe that's just the weight of playing this character that has to be all these things. And it's really good. It's not nomination worthy, but it serves the film perfectly. I just think he showed up and he did his job. And that's where I'm at. So I don't know if that's okay. Where you're going.
So you agree and disagree at the same time.
Yeah.
Noted. Noted. Yeah. So I think those were the only two things for me was these single line exposition things that I think were not needed. And that's, again, that's my own thing. And then all Timothée Chalamet's performance, I think, was just, you know, okay. The rest of it I thought was absolutely incredible. I remember on Dune 1, I said, you know, like, the music was great and all, and I am part of this world, but there was no motif or anything that I really noticed. I noticed whatever Hans Zimmer did, he like saved it for the second one, because, oh my God, this was fantastic. It just, there were motifs that he went back to, but they weren't they weren't supposed to be something that defined a moment. It was just supportive of what was going on screen. It was almost like the movie was made and then he scored it instead of the other way around. It was like done really in a smart way. And again, because I went back and watched Dune 1 before I watched Dune 2, again, just the sonic textures of everything in this film were just so incredible. The sound in general, not just the music, but the sound in general is probably one of the best I've ever seen, ever heard. Which especially like seeing it in IMAX, which makes it feel that much more real. I mean, I cannot stress to all of the filmmakers out there how important sound is. It is almost more important than what I'm seeing on screen to me. What I'm seeing is glorious, but it doesn't sound good, then what I'm seeing is shit. If what I'm seeing is okay, you know, could be done better, but it sounds fantastic, then all of a sudden it's like another stratosphere of a film for me. And this was great on both ends. The cinematography was just otherworldly. I mean, I felt like I was in an ocean of sand the entire time. The color, I don't know how you color something like this so beautifully, because there's sand everywhere. Everything has this orangish yellow hue, but you still have to see the blacks and you still have to see some color. Some color has to pop at moments, and how you shoot for that, how flat everything must be in camera. It's probably like looks like total garbage on set, you know, on purpose. But and how you don't get sand in all of the gear all the time. I just don't get it. But it just was amazing, and how real everything looked from those the scene that I noticed it the most was when they were hiding behind the leg of that crawler and they were trying to shoot the dragonfly thing that was shooting at them when Zendaya was trying to shoot it and he was taking fire for her. Paul was, and they were behind that leg, that giant leg that then picked up as he was running to it. It looked so real, man. And maybe it was done practically, I don't know, but oh my God, it looks so real. And there were a couple of great nuggets where Gurney, I didn't know that Gurney was still alive. And then, you know, 3/4 of the way through the movie, boom, he pops up in one of the fighters and he's playing that weird instrument. I'm like, yeah, Gurney, awesome. He's still alive. And so, yeah, that was great. And then seeing the whole scene of Paul jumping onto the back of the sandworm and riding it for the first time, that sequence was amazing because for so many reasons. The first reason is the perspective and the way that Denny sets it up. So he's going, you know, you have that interaction with Paul and Stilgar before he goes, and there's this funny moment, you know, that Stilgar gives him that you quoted earlier. And then he goes up to the top of this dune and to set up a thumper, and she says, lower, go lower. And he walks lower and he sets it lower. And you're thinking, why lower? Well, it's because you want the worm to be lower than the top of the dune. He sets it up lower and then he walks back up to the top. And that might seem like a duh thing, but when you're working on a film that's three films long, or four or five or whatever it is, and this one is almost 3 hours long, it's really easy to lose perspective of a scene from the viewing aspect, right? Like if you're the director and you're in it, that little moment of him going higher than the thumper was so important, you know, because that's exactly what the Fremen would do. If you think about it, you need to get above this thing. This thing's going to go at the thumper. You got to get above it. And then the whole sequence of him jumping on it. It's so disorienting. And yet I feel like I'm with him the whole time. And I feel disoriented because of the sand, but I also felt like grounded as well. They showed enough of the worm, the back of the worm, to make me feel like I was on it, you know, enough of him to make me feel alone, to make me feel detached from it, you know, and we're in close the whole time. And then we have to get the wide shot with the Fremen of him on it. And it's so satisfying because that's how we end the first. Sorry, should I say it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's how we end the first film, is seeing someone writing it. And now we're seeing Paul write it. We're seeing, oh my God, he's coming into his own. He's become part of these people. You know, it's such a wonderful sequence.
It is. And seeing, and it's such a nice payoff too, because at the end of the first part one, we see the woman setting up to use a worm, and we see the hooks and we're like, how is this going to work? And then we never get to see it because she gets attacked and killed.
Great point. Yes.
And so finally getting to see the practicality of how does that operate exactly? And watching him kind of fumble, but also kind of nail it. It's like, oh, then you see these close-ups of him pulling back, you know, the scale or the skin to reveal like an oxygen thing. You're like, oh, this is why they have to stay surface, because they have their lungs exposed.
Yes.
And they can't go under until they can properly cover up, like a dolphin or a whale or something. Like, you would want to stay up and so you don't drown in sand. And you can just mentally, again, they don't tell you all this. This is for you to piece together in your own head. And it's so satisfying. And I watched this twice in theater, and I was so tense both times. It's just, well, like you said, it's a great sequence. The sound design plays its part and the performance is good. Like, seeing those close-ups makes you really buy in, and it's so uncomfortable. And that's kind of the satisfying part too, is you feel uncomfortable for the worm. Seeing like that, you're like, oh, this is awkward. Is he hurting that worm? And you're like,
because you hear all that crackling, that, yeah, you know, you're like, oh, poor worm. You know, but I didn't even think of that though, that it can't go under because you've pulled back the folds and the sand will drown him essentially. So that's how they keep it up. I didn't even think of that. That's brilliant.
So good. It's so smart. And then once you finally establish all that, going into that wide, it feels not hokey. This was one of the problems of the first Dune, is like, that felt so hokey, and this feels right. It feels like, of course, that's how that operates. And I don't know if it's described. I'm waiting until all of these films finish, and then I'm going to go read the book. It feels like it's going to be a tedious read, just based on the era it was written in and how much detail is in this thing.
The other thing I will say about this is that it, one of the reasons I loved it is because it felt like it was made by somebody who loved the idea of it and has been waiting for their chance to put their own stamp on it.
Yeah.
Because, and the reason I say that is because I went back and I watched the first one, and then right after it, I started watching the original, which is bad, bad. Oh, don't do it. Don't do it. Just don't do it. I did it for you. Don't do it. And it's really bad, like comically bad, like so bad that if I hated you and I wanted you to have a bad experience, I still wouldn't recommend this film to you. That's how bad it is to me. Yeah. In all the ways. So for someone to see that and say, I can do that in a beautiful, meaningful, important way, so that everybody who's like Todd, who doesn't, and maybe Wes, who doesn't like that, can see the beauty in that story through another lens, you know, that has beauty in cinematography, beauty in sound, beauty in story, and tell it in a new way. And that's what I saw in Dune 2. I saw a guy loving this, in love with this, and having waited a long time to have the opportunity to do it. Yeah.
Agreed. Like, this story, I'll come back to it. I'm going to push through a few notes and then we'll see how much time we have remaining. Story and writing wise, it's always hard to do a follow-up. Like, this clearly is all planned out in Denny's head, and probably to some extent on paper. But how do you start a sequel? You know, and so the opening voiceover is actually really nice because it's refreshing us on part one very efficiently without belaboring anything. And it's doing that while introducing new characters, right? The Emperor and the Princess, because we're not going to get to spend a lot of time with them, but they're important to the story. And so it's good. And they're able to do all of that in like the span of, I don't know, 2 minutes. Here's some new characters. Here's kind of what happened in the backstory of, you know, part one. And here's why these characters matter to what you experienced in part one. If you watched both recently. And one of those lines that she says is, the Emperor saw, you know, Atreides like a son. But this was also not the first time House Harkonnen did dirty work for my father. And so she's telling you so much that, one, House Atreides is gone, and that it wasn't just the Baron's doing. It was ultimately strings that were pulled by the Emperor. And then you go one step further in that, I don't know if it's in that sequence or in another sequence. It might be in the opening, where we see the Reverend Mother, who acknowledges, like, of course it would, of course, you know, that was our doing. Why else would it have happened? And now we can kind of see the whole conspiracy at a glance of the Reverend Mother of the Bene Gesserit triggered a setting of events through the Emperor to take out House Atreides and go. And then we can go back to Arrakis, because we're going to spend so much time on Arrakis with Paul and Chani that it's good to, let's get a refresh without having to see Paul, you know, put his wrist to his forehead and faint, like, my house is gone, my father is dead, because of, like, let's insert that through the regret of a daughter who's about to inherit an empire, because now there's more emotional weight to that. So it's very lean and efficient and gives you a lot of perspective, because the princess isn't really happy about this, and we're getting some judgment of her father through her. And so there's a lot of perspective, a lot of emotion, a lot of contrast that they're doing in the opening 2 minutes. Like, it's really impressive writing from that standpoint of efficiency and, you know, world building. And then the other story and writing thing that I really like is the use of Na Baron, Faid Rautha, Rautha, or however you pronounce it, Dune. And and Na Baron is really nice because they develop him, and you need to develop him if you want a credible threat to Paul, you know, and you want a credible threat to Paul because you want some excitement in the third act. Where's your tension coming from, if not from Na Baron? And it's, there's a war, sure, but there's something at the end of that war that's, you know, much more dangerous than just bullets, you know, firing into the ether that, you know, are not going to hit Paul. You know, none of those bullets, none of those missiles, nothing's going to hit Paul. It's got to be something that matters. And so you need to develop someone, or a real credible threat. And in order to do that, you need to spend time with them. And Na Baron is really well developed, you know, in order to set up Paul's tension. And they do that first through, let's learn about him through the princess. Like, he's a psychopath, right? We already know Harkonnen is brutal, according to Gurney Halleck in part one. And so we cut to a psychopath of Harkonnen's, which is a lot. It's a hat on hat kind of stuff there. And we watch him kill the final Atreides, you know, prisoners. And the final one is undrugged, and so it's a real battle. And we see him boldly, right, his honor, right? He takes off his shield, and he goes toe-to-toe with this undrugged prisoner. And the way he kills the prisoner with that little knife flip, which is not revealed to the audience until you see him dead, basically. It's a nice little setup for his own death at the very end, because that's effectively, to a large degree, how Na Baron is killed. Is we don't see Paul remove the knife from himself and stab Na Baron. Okay, cool. So that's all reflected in that first battle. It's reflected in the last battle fight sequence. And I also really love that we get to see him kill a bunch of people along the way. You know, it's not just the journey, it's the people you killed along the way. And that for him is like his own slaves, the prisoners. He threatens his own uncle and his cousin, right? Like, this guy is bold, and he thinks he is the bee's knees. And then, of course, we see him go through and destroy all these sieges on Arrakis, their holy temple, right, with all the water. And so now you've built this guy up to be a really formidable opponent. And then you layer on top him being related to Paul. Now we have something worthy of a drama, because at the end of the day, this is a drama that has action in it. And we'll come back to that. But I love his death, even whenever he dies, right? What is he's looking at Paul, and he says, you fought well. Like, damn, honored to his last moment. And so it's such a well-written and executed character. And then on top of that, if all of that wasn't enough, the fight choreography of that final fight between him and Paul, freaking amazing. Like, I'm sure there's a stunt award or a fight choreography award. They won it. They won it because it's so tight. Like, they fight in these spurts. And so you believe, like, of course, you're going to take a break. But when they get going, it's bang, 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 bang. So fast. And so it doesn't feel like they sped it up at all in post. And you'll see that from time to time. Like, oh, let's speed up, you know, 10% or 20%. That felt all perfectly in camera. And to see those moments where they take their breaks felt natural. Like, okay, like, you can only fight so much, even in boxing. Like, world-class fighters within, you know, about are taking these little breaks. Like, they'll hug each other. They'll circle each other in the ring. And then they'll get into another spat, right? Like, that is all in there. And it's built into the choreography in a way that feels endemic to the story. And also, they found a really great break because walking into that fight, I was like, Paul is coming in with way too much swagger. He can't live. He can't get through this fight with that much swagger. He's got to get knocked down a peg. And so I was kind of wondering, is like, wait, does he actually die in this? And then he like has to bring himself back from the dead. I just didn't think he could live coming in that bold. And then the way they found it is, he gets whatever kicked and he's bleeding a little. That's fine. That's normal. Doesn't feel like enough. It's not until Nabarin turns around and sees Chani. And he's like, oh, this is your pet. And now when you start threatening his emotional well-being, that suddenly gives him the emotional stakes of, okay, now I'm fighting for something. Now I'm an underdog again. Because you need to find your hero as an underdog at some point in the fight, or else it just doesn't feel worth the victory. And I feel like that's how they got that emotional pull out of there, is through that little moment. Well done. God. Yeah. What did you think of that final fight sequence between?
It was amazing. And they didn't do the whole Rocky thing where, you know, he's doing well, and then he's not doing well, and then he's doing well, and he's not doing well, and then all of a sudden he wins. No, it didn't feel formulaic. It felt like he was struggling even when he had got some good hits in, which, yeah, to your point, felt like it was all one big fight. It wasn't like, it didn't feel like a series of takes. It felt like even when Paul was getting hits on Fred Rautha, it was at his own detriment. It was like taking energy from him to do that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Not like he was getting energy because he was hitting him, which is a typical kind of fight scene, I feel like. So it felt very real. I was just upset that Fade Rautha died. Like, take him into the next film. At the end of it too, I was like towards the end when that fight scene was happening, I was thinking, oh no, like please don't kill him right now. I want to see him in the next one. And then he dies. And I just remember thinking, oh, what now? Who is going to be
right,
the bad guy now after him? You know, it's kind of like, who's going to follow up the Joker, you know, right. So, anyway, there's obviously a plan. You know, I have seen that, music is already being written for the next one. So that's good. But, I'm sure that there's a plan in the storyline for a new bad guy. Cause Fade Rautha is dead and Baron Harkonnen is dead now, which, my God, like, if you think about the first one, it took the entire movie for Paul to kill one guy. And now he stared Baron straight in the face and stabbed him in the neck. You know, you're like,
oh, wow. Great point.
He's a totally different character now, you know, to stand on that hill in front of all the Fremen and say, I am your God, basically. Follow me. That is, I mean, I, you know, it seemed to me like when he did that, his character did that, it was out of necessity of I need all these people to follow me. Now I can see the future and I know what it holds. And if I don't get them to follow me blindly, like, and fully, then everyone will die instead of just a lot of them, kind of thing.
And you know what I love visually that they did whenever he's talking about all the possible paths, they do this close up on his hand.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful because it's actually like this little visual representation of what he's talking about, because he's got his fingers curled. And as he's talking about, I see all possible paths, it's like all these paths are streaming off from his hand. And he's like, any one of them could be, you know, lead to death. And most of them do. But I do see a narrow path. And that's when he lines his fingers all together to say that there is one way, and it's very narrow. Like, it's just this very simple, beautiful explanation visually instead of a chart. Like, we're going to use his fingers to demonstrate what he's talking about. And it's so subtle and not obvious at all. But you also see it in your head that much clearer because of what he's doing with his hands. That's just little touches, man.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And then I you know, wait for the next one, but I'm not sure why he doesn't tell Chani, you know, that he needs to marry the emperor's daughter. Like, well, why doesn't he clue her in to, like, this is like, I love you. I have to do this, but I love you and whatever. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason.
I'm sure. And I suspect it's because he needs Chani to go accomplish some other task. Mm-hmm. And she can only do that if she's mad at him and doesn't want to be next to him.
Yeah. Probably.
Probably. But it's satisfying because so far I've only talked to you and one other person about this film, and we all think he's playing a part, but he's playing it so well that you understand why Chani's upset.
I mean, the way that I will say, to his credit, the way that he looks at her, you know, after he says, I will marry your daughter to the emperor, and he looks at her, he's not looking at her hopeful that she'll understand.
Yeah.
He's looking at her like this is happening. Get on board, you know, kind of thing. Like, he's directing the ship.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I didn't like any of his Timothy Chalamet's performance. I just, I agree with you that it could be more layered. There could be more of an onion there. But there were moments where I thought that he did a really great job. And that was definitely one of them.
An onion a parfait. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. I see the change like in his character. Yeah. So that's good.
For sure.
I did really love Rebecca Ferguson too. Oh,
God. Yeah, she's
in this too. I mean, I just love her and everything that she does. She's fantastic, but she just goes, everybody changes so much. I feel like, except for Chani, right? Like, Chani is always, she's just the same. And same, I mean, I guess same for Javier Bardem and for Stilgar and for Gurney. Yeah. They're the same, but Timothy Chalamet changes, Rebecca changes. So Paul and Jessica, they both change. So I guess just those two.
Yeah.
They change a lot. You know, Jessica turns into like a really typical Bene Gesserit.
Controlling and manipulating everything.
Yes, yes, for sure. She turns into the Reverend Mother, essentially, in a way. And God damn it, man, the use of the voice scares the shit out of me every time. But it's amazing. It's just incredible the way that you can tell a story through sound, the way that you manipulate a sound. Just saying a word that, you know, like a sentence, a few words, like move, you know, but
yeah,
you have this pre-delay thing that comes in. It's just unbelievable.
And it's
unbelievable, believably effective.
And it was so satisfying watching Paul hit the Reverend Mother with that. Whenever she's about to say, you don't understand, silence, or, you know, and she just suddenly has terror in her eyes. That's so satisfying.
So satisfying, dude. Oh my God. I loved that moment so much.
Oh,
because I hate her. She's just like the worst, which is great acting.
Yeah. Right. Right. Great. You know what I mean? Charlotte Rampling. My God.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how much time they spent in pre-production figuring out the right cloth to cover her face that allows you to see enough of her expressions, but not too much, you know, that you, there's no point in even having the veil. Yeah. Like, great cost, the wardrobe and costume, sound design. These are all Oscar worthy things that people are going to get just a lot of new decorations for their house because it's so good.
I think a lot of that, the Bene Gesserit thing, it came from, I read somewhere, it came from like back in the early 1700s, 1800s, there were these nuns in South America these hooded nuns, and they had these giant hoods, like freaky looking, huge hoods that they always wore. They weren't allowed to not wear them in public. And yeah, so they kind of like modeled it more of a vertical version, I guess, for the Bene Gesserit, whatever. But I love the Bene Gesserit.
Yeah.
Kind of like angle here of like these women who have for hundreds of years just, you know, finagled their way into things. And like, they're the ones who really control everything, even though, you know, these, like, the emperor thinks he controlled. No, you know, Reverend Mother really does.
But at the end of the day, as we learn in the opening weird voiceover, power over spice is power over all. Yeah. And that's the importance of Arrakis, I guess. And seeing Paul drink the juice and live, he got a lot of powers. And so it'll be interesting to see what all that means.
Yeah.
Cinematography wise, and I think this goes into directing and cinematography, but the dramatic pauses in this film are so good. And this is a Denny classic, right? Like, he just knows how to frame a moment and let it breathe before moving on. And so at the very beginning, when we, you know, get back together with Paul and Chani, we see the soldiers, you know, are hunting, and they hear the worms being called, and like, oh, let's get to the rocks. And so they fly up and they get in this nice perch, and they're waiting there to see, you know, if the worm is going to come or not. And we see the lead soldier in the front. And he's like, okay, we're good. Vip, right. And then he gets struck in the head. Now, we know in real life, you get shot in the head, you're done. Like, you fall down. But here, he gets shot in the head, and we push in on him. Then we push in on his team. And then we reverse, and we wait. And then he falls. Like, it's so many dolly pushes and slow creeps, and it all feels very inevitable and fixed and epic. Like, and it's just a Denny move of how to build suspense in a moment. Before you unleash hell, because after that moment, everything starts happening very, very fast. And it's like, let's take this big breath and then let's run. Let's just run through this all. And it's so satisfying. And it's just beautiful. And it's one of those things that transcends Dune, because it's a Denny thing. It's something that ties all his films together. You're able to see Denny in Sicario, in Dune, in Arrival, and you're like, I know I'm watching Dune, and it's so specific that everything in here is Dune, but I still feel Denny. Like, it's a nice style thing that it's one of those things that as a director, if you can find a way to be you, it'll live through all your films. And for Denny, that's one of his hallmark things, is I'm going to go really wide and I'm going to slowly push in. And it's going to create a lot of suspense. But likewise, that's not all of Dune. He uses a lot of handhelds, like in shots in his close-ups. And so, like, it gives us this intimate, grounded thing, right? We're in a sci-fi, but suddenly it's not epic and it's very human. And that's adding this layer of unpredictability. It's just by switching to handheld moves so that we can connect emotionally with our characters as they're going through whatever relationship stuff that they're going through. The other nice thing cinematography-wise, exposure. Like, they use exposure to help tell the story all the time. The desert, super harsh, right? It's overexposed almost, and it's really hard lighting, right? And it feels uninhabitable. Like, this is brutal. Of course, those guys are in their weird, you know, spacesuits walking around the desert. Those pale, pasty white boys are not going to make it on this planet. And so let's put it to them. But at the same time, now we go to the nighttime and they do this, all that day for night stuff. The desert suddenly looks a lot more safe, and they've lowered the exposure. You know, the light is a lot softer on their faces. It's really, really nice use of exposure to help tell emotionally the story of what's happening and the vulnerability of the characters given what scenario they're in. In the same way, like, when you go to the Gaiety Prime, way bright. Like, those mofos are one breath from being overexposed. There's still usually a little texture on their white skin, but the sun is white, right? It's hot. But no one in this movie sweats. That's kind of wild. Like, I don't remember seeing anyone sweat ever.
Agreed. Yeah. Right? How is that possible? Are the suits that good? Yeah,
they're retaining everything. But the nice thing, going back to Arrakis, I love, and this is that scene we played at the opening. They're blocking they're backlighting with the sun. And they do it in a way that I find really interesting. And it's normal. I'm not saying they're doing anything unique here. It's very, very common, I think. But the way they do it is they backlight with the sun, probably bring in some bounce, right? Some whatever 20 by ultra bounce kind of thing to fill in light so that you're not completely overexposing your background. So they're facing the actor away from the sun, right? And it's giving a really nice edge light, hair light, right? And also allowing you to get some nice soft light on their face because you're able to wrap the soft light around through the use of the bounce. And what's cool though is the reverse angles, right? Because we shoot all over the map on that scene. We're seeing in front of them, we're seeing behind them. We're getting a full 360 degree view basically of these characters. And yet the sun is always in the back. They're always backlighting the sun. And what I love there is that it's a total cheat, right? They're using the sun to create a consistent look so that no matter which angle we cut to, the audience doesn't see the cheat because the look stays consistent. The lighting always feels the exact same. And therefore, we don't really notice that the sun is always on one side of the screen. Instead, you almost expect it. It's one of those movie magic things. And the really good thing about this is it allows you to do what I think they're doing here. So just to finish that point, whenever we're establishing where the sun is, we see the sun behind Zendaya, right? And no matter where we cut now, as long as if you see the sun and they use the sun in the shot, which is always a dicey proposition, but we establish the sun directly behind Zendaya. You see it in frame. And now as long as the sun is not in frame everywhere else, we just imagine it's always behind Zendaya because that's where you visually established it. And so keeping the sun out of frame the rest of the shots gives you a lot of opportunity to cheat and make your day. Because otherwise, now maybe they spent a whole day shooting this thing. I don't know, maybe it was in a volume. I honestly cannot tell. I would imagine they shot this practically with the sun. But I don't know that that's what they did because it's, you get a lot of money and it's so well shot. Who knows? But if I'm putting money, I think that's an actual outdoor location. Not that they're in the desert, but maybe they're in a studio lot and they're painting in some dunes in the background. I don't know, whatever. But what you can tell is whenever they cut to that wide shot, the helicopter crane shot, whatever they're doing there, it looks like a helicopter, but the lens flare is still telling you that the sun is now behind them, even though they've completely switched positions. And here's what I think it allows you to do, is it allows you to do what I've heard called a French reverse. And I heard this while shooting a Pepsi commercial with John Toll. And this was when I was into filmmaking, and so I was paying more attention. I can only imagine all the stuff I could have learned if I'd been more into cinematography in my early acting career. But being on set as an actor for this Pepsi commercial, John Toll, I'm just kind of leaning in, listening to anything John Toll says. And he is like, yeah, so we've got this shot and we were shooting the first Super Bowl halftime. And so there's offense and defense, you know, offense is on the left, defense is on the right. And we have this beautiful backdrop in the hills and the sun is coming up over the hills and it's just gorgeous. And if you want to shoot both sides, right? Well, now you're gonna have to move your camera. Okay, we've established, you know, we're on whatever, the south side. The offense is on the left, the defense is on the right. Now, if you want to move to the other side, and visually the offense is now on the right, and defense is on, and they're switching positions. Now you're going to have to move all your equipment, right? You have cranes and your video village and all that stuff. A French reverse suddenly just says, we're not going to move any of that stuff. Instead, we're going to go closer, and now you can't see the background as well. And instead, you're going to get them to everyone just swap around. And so offense is going to move to the other side of the line. And then you're going to also say reverse order. And so if your tight end was down, you know, by camera, now they're going to go to the other side. Now you're just going to have whatever your tackle. And so everyone rotates. And it's like you completely rotated everything around as if it's on a big turntable. And now, because you're shooting closer, you can't tell the background that much. it's all kind of the same thing as long as you don't see the sun in the shot. And I think that's probably what they did. Instead of shooting all day this scene, waiting for the sun to get back into position, let's just shoot it very fast. Let's get Paul or Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya to swap positions and move to the other side of the hill. And now it just, because we're moving in on close-ups, it just looks the same because the background of this infinite desert doesn't shift. It's always going to look blurry and deserty in the background. It's a total easy cheat that saves you a lot of setup and time because audience cannot tell the difference anyway. So why not? It's just when the opportunity presents itself. Now, if you're shooting in a city and you have this big red building, you can't French reverse that because big red buildings are not dime a dozen. Instead, you really need to physically move stuff around. But if you can, if the background all looks the same, why not? Why not? You don't have to move the camera, move the actors. And that's, you know, broadly speaking, what they call a French reverse. Yeah.
Brilliant.
I like it. Okay. So final thoughts, which is, is it just me or does Dune start to feel like the real origins of Star Wars? I was really mad. It took me a day to cool off because Christopher Nolan dropping that comparison to Empire Strikes Back completely cued me into what I was going to see. Now, luckily, the buildup wasn't the same. Like the end of Empire Strikes Back, which is his reference, was it's one of the most famous moments in Hollywood history. Luke, I am your father. Right. And this is why we put the spoiler in. And that reveal is the entire point of Empire Strikes Back. If you reference that movie, that's what you're referencing, you know, in my mind. It's not just, it's the really best Star Wars of all three. Sure, that's true. But it's also the point of that movie is the reveal. It's wildly famous. And so I thought it was just really silly of Christopher Nolan, who just blows my mind because this guy lives in a cave. Like he doesn't have email or social media. He doesn't even have a cell phone and he pops up to drop that. It's like, bro, you're smarter than that. And so I was fully anticipating this twist of Paul being related to Harkonnen or the Emperor. I wasn't sure which one, but I knew it was going to be one or the other. And so that reveal, you know, really that, when you were talking about earlier about moments that took you out, that took me out. And I had to fight to get back into it. And then once I calmed down and cooled off, I was like, okay. And I rewatched the film. I enjoyed the ending way, way more the second time through, just because I wasn't in my head as much anymore. But even moving away from that specific like Wes experience, like Star Wars feels like it took a lot of inspiration from Dune. You know, it's like, wow. Like to me, that means two things. One, Dune is shaping up to be a much more fulfilling experience, you know, on the whole, just because there's so much more going on. Whereas Star Wars really honed in on a very specific family. That's the kind of soap opera aspect of Star Wars. This feels so much bigger. There's so many more. The world building is wildly, wildly bigger than Star Wars. And that makes me think that this is going to be so much more interesting and the dynamics are going to keep shifting. And I'm more excited to see where this goes because of all that world building in the books. But it's also kind of cool just because, you know what, who cares? The inspiration was there and he made something and he still made it his own. It's not like Star Wars is a straight copy paste. There's still so many things that make Star Wars, Star Wars, even whenever you see the inspiration that's clearly there. That's okay. Like he made his own thing and it doesn't really matter where you take your inspiration from as long as, you know what, you make it your own. Yeah, I find a lot of the inspiration. And to me, I don't know, it's kind of cool just to see someone made something massive and mega and it's still its own thing, I think. Yeah. Did you feel the inspiration coming from, because Dune was like over a decade before Star Wars came out, the book. And so, yeah. Do you see overlap there?
I mean, yeah. How can you not, you know, in a lot of ways, but I did hear at one point the whole Luke, I am your father thing wasn't originally supposed to be part of it. And like, it was supposed to be something else and they changed it. I don't know if it was at the last minute or whatever, but so I do think that obviously there are obvious parallels there. I'm just looking at them as totally different things, because you have the way, yes, you have an emperor, but really it's them fighting in Star Wars, them fighting the empire as a whole. And in this case, it was just, at first, it was mostly the Harkonnen, and now it's expanding. So it's like, and so now they're going to basically fight all the houses, is the way that it's going down. So you're right in that they took, if it is inspired by Dune, which I think it is, they took the entirety of the Fremen now fighting everyone to fighting one group called the Empire, right? Mm. In Star Wars, like the Empire, like this one thing. And yes, there's an emperor behind it as well, but now there is no emperor really. Yeah. You know, there's Paul and the Fremen, and against basically the entirety of the galaxy. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you want to look at it, all the houses. So you're right, it does feel like a larger, expansive kind of feel, like almost like the story is blooming, the conflict is blooming into something more. You know, whereas at the in Star Wars, it just is. It already exists. Like, it's all. In fact, if you're not paying attention, it's kind of like you don't know what happened. You don't know that, oh, the Empire used to be good and it was a good thing, and now it's not. And now you're fighting against it because they've turned bad. You don't know that yet because it's the middle three. So yeah, it's almost like it's blooming into this bigger kind of thing. And that doesn't make me mad. Yeah. You know, it's sci-fi. Yeah. How can you not be inspired, you know, to make something, to just make something? And of course, everything's been done. So it's not a matter of doing something new. It's a matter of doing your thing in whatever way you're doing, which cannot help but be new in many cases, unless you literally steal. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not mad about it. Yeah. I'm just, I'm glad that now Dune is getting its, yeah, it's due. Like, that's what I'll say, because I think that Star Wars has been run into the ground so much. They've beat that up so much that we need something new. We need like a new premise, and this feels grounded more, because I mean, a lot of Star Wars takes place in outer space, and 99% of Dune takes place on a planet somewhere. There's very few shots in outer space, very few. So it feels grounded. It feels more like you can identify with the characters, even the bad guys. You know, the only thing that makes me look at this as like sci-fi even is that you have these giant crafts that hover, right? Or that, you know, slowly descend down to the planet. Like, that doesn't exist. So, okay, cool. And then every now and then we get a reminder, this giant shot of like this huge ship in outer space. But other than that, it feels like like there's more parallels to real life and to doing the wrong thing for the right reason sometimes. And you know, you ask, yeah, it addresses questions. It's like much more of a identifiable, I think, story.
Yeah. And I love that so many things, like, it doesn't rely on the technology to make it sci-fi. I think a lot of modern sci-fi stuff, that's exactly what they're doing. They're relying on the technology to make it cool and interesting, instead of allowing your characters and the dynamics and what their characters are after to really define the story and your experience in the movie. And this is, all that is just side dish. It's like, it's there, but it's hardly talked about. They introduce it just so that you know what it is and how it's functioning. And then they never talk about it again. And they only use it when the characters should be using it, or to make a point. The characters are going to purposefully not use the technology. And it's all there to serve story. And I just think it's so damn cool. Denny keeps taking these wildly ambitious shots. There's no reason he should have done Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? There's no reason to take on Dune. What? And the fact that he keeps getting rewarded by audiences is so satisfying, because there's so many, maybe not so many, but there are other directors that are making good stuff that aren't getting rewarded. And I don't know why. I don't know why people keep showing up for Denny, who's brand new on the scene. His story as a director is, will just melt your heart. Like, we were sharing this on Instagram, you know, a month or two ago about him making his first movie and it sucked and it did nothing. And he waits, you know, whatever, 5-6 years. He's like, okay, I think I've learned a lot now. It's time to do another one. And he makes another one and it does nothing. It goes nowhere. And he's like, okay, maybe I'm just done. And then he says, you know what? Oh, I really like this play. And he waits another 5-6 years. He's been a stay-at-home dad and just enjoying his life. And he's like, oh, and now he's 43 and he makes another little indie film. And suddenly it gets recognized. It goes to the Oscars and they give him, hey, you want to make this other little movie? And then he makes Prisoners and Enemy, but Prisoners blows up and then it just launches him. And he was done. He was in his 40s. He was like, it's my time came and went. And I just didn't have what it takes. And now he's becoming the biggest director on the planet by taking these outrageous risks. Like, this isn't a guaranteed home run. This isn't Batman, right? That's how Christopher Nolan got his name in the bank, was he went and made a comic book series that crushed. And that got him the ability to do whatever he wanted. Denny came and said, I'm going to make Sicario. I'm going to make Arrival.
Yeah.
And then I'm really going to shoot myself in the foot with Blade Runner. No one's ever going to work with me again. And yet people loved it. People loved Dune Part One. That's so satisfying. And I don't know why it's working. I don't know why people love Dune. I know why I love it, but it's not because it's a popcorn seat of your pants movie. It's such a patient movie. He took 2.5 hours in Part One to go hardly anywhere. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I remember that. I remember being in the theater with you. I think it was with you, right?
Maybe so.
In the theater with you. And it said Part One or whatever at the end of it. I was like, ah, shit, really? Damn. Cause yeah, it didn't really go anywhere, but there were these moments of payoffs throughout where you're like, oh, that's so cool. Still, my favorite moment in any, I think maybe even any sci-fi film, maybe not any sci-fi film, but like in recent days, is a moment in Dune One, and it doesn't give anything away.
Yeah.
But where Baron is eating at the table and you just hear this nasty eating, right? And then he floats up across the table and drags his feet. And it just felt so like real, like he is so lazy. He can't even float high enough to get over the table and just gross. And it was just such a wonderful moment. And those are the moments I think that like that we find throughout where we're not listing them, but there are these like tiny little things where if you blink, you miss it, but you've missed something that's like super important that really grounds the character or the world or the experience or the scene or whatever. There's all these little moments in every scene almost. And he does that just so beautifully. And it just comes from a place of love. Like, I think he loves what he does and he loves the stories that he's telling, and that's the only ones that he wants to make. And so he just does that. And at this point in his career, he's able to do that. And that's great. But to your point, he wasn't destined for this. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, like someone like Spielberg or Scorsese was just destined to be a director. I mean, maybe some people may seem like that, but a lot of people, and Denny's a great example of that. I don't think that he was destined to do this. I think that he just didn't stop, you know, like he paused, he collected himself, he lived his life. And then he decided when the time was right, he wanted to do something for himself. And that turned into something which then he capitalized on by doing that even better. And then, you know, turned into something else. And now we have this body of work from him, from Enemy to Prisoners to Dune. That's just, it's, you're right. It has his stamp on it. And that stamp is a certain thing that you kind of like just feel, you know, and you, because you're a filmmaker, can spot that and you can call that out, like these patient moments. But most people couldn't call that out. Most people just watch it and they think, oh, yeah, it feels comforting because they've seen it before in his other films. They don't know why. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just so cool. And I think that Dune 2 is no exception. It does its job and then some, and it makes you, I got just mad. I have to wait however long for the next one, you know? Yeah.
He has to keep getting whatever he wants. Like, I don't know what else. I want him to make part three, and I'm hoping that's that everything he wants to do. Now, I'm not going to be mad if there's a part four, because I'm loving this series, but I'm also like, what else does he want to do? What else is out there for Denny to make? And I want to see what else he's inspired by and what other stories he wants to tell. Because I also love that he works with, you know, a writing partner, and I don't think it's a consistent partner. He's humble enough to be like, I don't need to have my name alone on the script. I just want to make the best film possible. Therefore, yeah, I'll bring in John Spates, and they're making magic. Like, why not? And maybe the next story isn't a good fit for John Spates. Maybe he's like, oh, you know what? Your strength really was, you know, we had a shared love of Dune. But this other story, you know, I think, whatever, Jonathan Nolan. Like, I need to go write with this thing with Jonathan Nolan, because he gets the science fiction of this side of whatever. Like, I just love that he seems like the most humble dude. Without knowing anything about him, I was reading like some stories of people who have worked with him, and they're just like, that dude, you would never know that he is who he is because of just how chill and unassuming he is and unimportant about himself. Like, cool. God.
How? My neighbor, he used to live near my neighbor and like out here, or have a place, I guess, or whatever. And one of his friends worked at the time at some store. And this was years ago, and Denny would come in all the time. And I think this is like during the days of Prisoners or something, or maybe Arrival. And he would come in all the time with his family and just like, you know, hang out. He was always the most gracious, nicest guy and unassuming kind of thing. So I have firsthand or secondhand corroboration of that like, he's just the, you know, and that's so wonderful, because especially when you're trying to do something creative with 150 or 300 other people, you know, like, somebody's got to run the ship, but to do it in a way that makes everybody feel seen and heard, and that, you know, you're the final say, but at the same time, you know, it's not a this feeling of like, oh my God, it's the boss. It's this feeling of, hey, we're all in this, making this thing together. I imagine like a Tarantino set is not like that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. We're like, oh no, he's the at last word. You know what I mean? I imagine it would be fun and fulfilling, you know, as an artist in whatever capacity you're working on a Denny set. That's just what I imagine. I don't know.
Yeah, same. I completely agree. Like, I would do anything to be a fly on the wall to PA, you know, set, you know, just let me hang out and see the inner workings a little bit, pull that. And yeah, God, there's a handful of sets like that where I would just kill to be a fly on the wall. And his is certainly one of them. The Daniels, I've heard, also run a really, really amazing set. And I've heard great things about Nolan. Like, I hear he's very collaborative with everyone on set. And that's really, really cool too. Yeah. So good to have heroes, man.
Yeah, man, it really is. As long as we never meet them.
That's correct. Stay. Can you imagine? Denny is walking across the room. Stay over there. Don't come any closer. Oh, man.
I mean, I do wonder, like, you know, in his first movies where he had like hard budgets and stuff, and I think really that's probably, I would imagine that's where a director gets a little bit, you know, I mean, you could probably speak, right? Where you're running up on budget and you only have this amount of time and we don't have another day to shoot. Somebody drops something in the middle of a take or something, like, and you're stressed out. You know, how do you keep that together, you know?
Yeah, when you're working with a big team, and like you said, whenever you have the budget to have that extra 5 days of filming, yeah, you know what? You can wrap on time if you're good at your job. But if you don't have the budget and one thing goes wrong, one thing, your whole schedule gets cascaded, right? And just wrecked. And suddenly you're running over. And it doesn't take much. And so Yeah, you're right. You can probably be a lot more chill and collaborative whenever you do get that extra week of filming, or even that one extra day, safety day or whatever, some flex days. Like that changes the game, I'm sure, a lot for everyone.
Yeah. I heard this was a $190 million budget, and I think it made $170 million in the first week. Yeah, I know.
Come on.
Come on. Yeah. In the first week, bro. God, it's crazy.
This could get...
What for dorky sci-fi part two, God. You know?
Because part one ended up making 400 and opened on 40.
Ooh, yeah.
This could cross a billion globally.
Good.
Good.
Great. The last thing that I will say is I just want to send a shout out and a thank you to not just... the directors like Nolan and Denny, who are freaking saving cinema right now.
Yeah.
The last 2 years have been terrible, and coming out of the pandemic. And look, I don't fault most people because like during the pandemic, how do you make anything during a freaking pandemic that nobody has experienced before, that literally everything was shut down. Everybody forgot how to make good films. And to have people like Nolan, you know, making Oppenheimer and Denny making Dune, it's the keeping people going to cinema, going to the movies. It's more necessary now than it ever has been in history of cinema. Like, it's so important because we have these tools, and if people forget how to use them, they forget what a really great film looks like, then we're destined for Netflix shit for the rest of our lives. And that would be a travesty. So I just want to thank them first, but really I also want to thank the studios. Yeah, we're going to bet $200 million on this story and you as a director, and we're just going to do what you want. I mean, dude, can you imagine that? Like you know, you're the head of a studio and you have a budget of $350 million in a year or something like that. And you're going to give over half of it to one film. You know, and then cross your fingers. You know, we're not talking about a Blumhouse where they're going to invest one or three or four million. We're talking $190 million. And they just gave it to him. They said, do it. I mean, yes, you know, there's only a handful of directors I think that any studio would do that for, but that still exists, you know, today is amazing.
Without having to completely agree. Because outside of that, how many films are really getting that? I mean, it's all like comic books films and massive, well-established properties. Dune is not that. It's very, the way Denny's approaching it is very high-minded science fiction. Like, you're not.
Yeah. Like, I mean, even like Everything Everywhere All at Once, like that was not a high budget film. All like a lot of the effects were practical. And they did a shoestring budget, you know, and that was like a giant film. It still is. So
$25 million budget on that.
Okay, so $25 million, which is still a lot of money. But if you think about it in terms of like what it is and what the world it built, it's kind of incredible. And the people that were in it, it's kind of incredible. So you have that at one level, and then you've got this, which is, you know, this sci-fi epic, sci-fi is already expensive. You know, going into it, but this grandiose way that Denny wanted to do it, just gigantic. And it's a huge, huge gamble for anybody at that studio. Yeah. So what was it? Legendary?
Yeah.
Who else? I'm not sure. I know Legendary. I couldn't remember who else.
I thought Warner Brothers, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. So Warner Brothers is the parent, and then Legendary is like,
I don't know how that works.
They're part of it. I don't know how that works, but, you know, the faith that they had to have in a day where so much shit is made and put out is just awesome. And kudos to them, to the studio. Kudos to Denny for not, you know, wavering on his vision. I just want to pull a little bit more out of Timothée Chalamet for part three.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say.
Yeah, completely agree. Man, I cannot be more excited. And my roommate was telling me that apparently he's going to take his time on part three. So he might do another project in between.
Ooh.
I don't know if that's all verified or not, but if so, I'm on board for all of that. Like, do that. Take your time. Get it right. I'm really, really impressed how fast he put this one out after part one. Like, that's outrageous for a 2 hour, 40 minute, film, like, to turn it around that quickly. That's outrageous.
When did part one come out? When was that? Was
at the end of 2021.
21? Yeah.
So 2.5 years.
That's crazy. Yeah. Jeez. God,
really impressive. Nice. What are you going to recommend this week?
I was going to recommend sci-fi, but then I was like, nah, not really feeling that right now. So kind of another heady film that I'm surprised that we haven't recommended, honestly, because it's just so, so good and kind of timeless, honestly, for me. I'm going to recommend Lost in Translation.
Oh, nice.
Which is kind of like, it's weird and you don't really understand some of it, like what the motivations are about some of the characters, I guess, sometimes. But it's still beautiful. It's beautiful. It's just like a human interaction film. And so I'm going to recommend Lost in Translation.
Nice. Yeah, I feel like I need to rewatch that. I really like Sofia Coppola. I think she is really fantastic. I'm going to recommend a book. If you enjoyed the book Dune and you're looking for another fun sci-fi story, I really like this. I just read it a few weeks ago, called Children of Time. It's by Adrian Tchaikovsky. It's really fascinating. The world building is fantastic. It's different because of how much is jumping around in time or jumping forward in time. The story feels a little bit erratic, but it's building something. And I'm excited to see. I think it's a trilogy. There's two or three books. And that first book tells such a wonderful story of imagination. And it's a new direction of, I don't know, it's of humanity and what humanity is capable of. And it's building on, it opens on this idea that we're colonizing planets, or we've been, what do you call it? Terraforming planets in the galaxy. And it's like, okay, well, what do we do? How do we use these planets now? And one scientist is like, I'm going to use this planet that we terraformed to try to create my own life. And they've inserted a bunch of life from Earth onto it, spiders, snakes, ants, like they've, as a part of the terraforming process. And now she's injecting a nanovirus onto the planet that aids evolution. And it's supposed to help jump evolutionary progress forward in time. And the idea is she's going to insert a bunch of monkeys. And, okay, I'm going to try to make humans 2.0. And let's see how this goes. And because of the way the virus works, it's going to make it all happen much, much faster. That way I can go to sleep for, a few hundred years. And when I wake up, I will get cavemen. And then I'll go to sleep for a few hundred years. And then I'll have, Greeks or whatever. And now... what happens? Oh, crap. The monkeys died, in process. Crap. What happens now? What's going to evolve now on this planet? And it walks you through over the course of the book of what else evolves on that planet. And it'll surprise you. And it's really cool. And I'm excited to see where the second and third books go, because that's such a cool premise.
That's cool.
Very surprising. And the places that he goes with it. Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. It's fun. I like experimental science fiction like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and stay tuned for next week. We are covering another sci-fi classic, Back to the Future. And what was really fun for me walking out of my second viewing of Dune, you'll never guess what song was playing on the PA.
Gonna go back in time.
Close. It was Power of Love. They had Power of
Yeah, so good.
Oh, so stay tuned for that. We're really excited to see what Marty McFly is gonna have happening there. And if you're enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe, drop us a review, leave us a note. If there's something you want us to cover, you tell us. What are we missing? What's not in the oeuvre of the Pestle? And we'll be happy to take a look. And if you want to comment on this episode, you can do that at thepestlepodcast.com/DunePart2. That's the number 2.
And our quote of the day is a good one from George R.R. Martin. You can have the power to destroy, but it doesn't give you the power to reform or improve or build. That is such a strong statement. I mean, I think it's one of those things where like you kind of know that or you sense that, but until somebody puts it into words, this is one of the great things about quotes that I love. Yeah. Like, you know, it's taking something that you already know and putting it into words that kind of just trigger something in your brain, like reminds you maybe in a way, yeah, of something that you already knew. I think this is a great statement.
It's so good because when Paul says that comment in the film, one who can destroy has the real power of the thing. I get so frustrated. I'm like, that's such a type of power. But I love George because I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, oh, I wonder what George R.R. Martin has to say about world building. So I just started going through his quotes and I found this. And I was like, nope, we're going with this because that is so smart. And I think there's so many people in this world of Dune who really take that attitude of it's much easier to, you know, take control over things through destruction. And it's what morons do. They only look to destroy. They don't look to create. And a lot of the people who judge and critique, even on, you know, stuff like what we do, they're only looking at tearing down. They're looking at crapping on someone else's work and not looking for inspiration or looking at, and they're never risking themselves in the process.
Yeah.
It's so much more easier to just destroy someone else's, you know, work, which is all GIFs are. Like, I get a laugh out of a GIF as much as anyone or a meme, but they're just looking to rip apart someone else's work and to act like they're brilliant. Like, Denny just spent, you know, 3 years putting together this film, and for someone to just, you know, pull apart, you know, 3 seconds to make fun of it or something, you know, like, it's just well done. I mean, you
this is a great quote of like how I think we approach our podcast too.
Yeah.
That I love is, yeah, we can go in and say that if we liked or didn't like a film, but we give reasons, and at the same time we have mad respect always on every film, no matter whether we like it or not, of all the people. And we say it, we literally say it out loud. Like this film is not for me, but I have mad respect for, man, this took a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of people had to put everything they had into it. And I think that that's what this is. It's easy for us to sit back and say, oh my God, this is a terrible film, but that's not our point. Our point is to call out what worked, what didn't work that we think. And in order for maybe people who listen or just the filmmaking process in general to improve, to get better, you know, to let's call out the things that don't work so that maybe somebody who would have made that decision in a year or 2 years doesn't make that decision. Like, oh yeah, I remember that didn't work in that film. Okay, I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it a different way. Like that's the point. We're trying to improve. We're trying to reform stuff that doesn't work into stuff that does, you know,
because there's so many things that do work. And yes, it's so inspiring to see, man, like one, it could have worked better, or here's what took me out, or even better, and this is like 95% of what we do, is, man, that was cool, I would love to use that, I would love to implement that, or learn from that. Like, God, all the things Denny does is just inspiring. And if I get to, these are all tools in the tool belt, and you use tools for specific things. And that's the whole, when you have a hammer, everything's a nail. Well, if you have a hammer and you have a buzzsaw and you have, you know, a ruler and you have all these other tools, then you can just use those things when it's appropriate. And I love using this as a means of, it's my tool belt. I'm just trying to build out my tool belt. And even before the show, I was talking about a new script that I wrote, and I was like, I'm using this idea that we learned from Fury, that they did in Fury, and I was like, man, that was a tool that I finally got to pull out of my tool belt and say, ah, here's a good time to use that, and when it's appropriate. And yeah, we're building on what other people are doing, or we're trying to. Yeah,
yeah.
Good awesome. Stuff, man. Good stuff.
So much fun. So much fun. Hopefully you guys have enjoyed this. I know I have. Can't wait for the next one. Like Wes said, please subscribe, review us wherever you get your podcasts, share us with friends. It all helps. If there's a film that we have not covered, which there's a lot, please suggest. Who knows? Maybe we'll cover it in the future. And until next time, I'm Todd.
I'm Wes.
go watch some movies.
May your knife chip and shatter.
May your knife chip and shatter.
I love his response because he's kind of like amused by it. He's like, may your knife chip and shatter.
Yeah, that's true.